Welcome to Essential Knowledge Updates RCGP podcast. My name is Dr. Thomas Round and I'm a clinical lead for the EKU program and also an academic GP in London. And today I'm talking to a colleague, Adam Sullivan, who is an academic GP trainee in London and co-authored a recent BJGP paper on chronic pain and looking at the NICE guidelines. Hi, Adam.
Hi.
And we're talking today about your recent paper in the British Journal of Practice, which is actually based on one of our EKU modules on the recent NICE chronic pain guidelines.
Yeah, so these are the NICE chronic pain guidelines from 2021 that came out and just reviewing what is useful for the kind of busy GP and what they need to know from these new guidelines.
So all GPs will be used to sort of chronic pain patients. It is a complex area, and it was quite a controversial guideline, I think.
There are a few things that raised some controversy. The main thing that got a lot of people's attention was that they recommended against use of any of your traditional analgesic medications, and the only medication they would recommend as a group would be the antidepressants. They were the key things that stood out that raised a bit of controversy that we talked about in the article.
How did you find reviewing the guideline and the changes?
So it's interesting, you know, NICE themselves acknowledges that this tends to be an under-researched area, and often a real challenge is around definitions, distinguishing between chronic primary pain versus chronic secondary pain, and how do you distinguish that in the studies. So it was interesting to try and tease this apart and trying to understand as well from a kind of a holistic point of view how you translate a guideline for everyone into the specific person in front of you.
And that messy world of primary care that we Absolutely. Live in, which is, you know, actually taking the research guideline and how do we implement it in that patient in front of us. So just going back a little bit, you mentioned about the definitions. Would you be able to just talk us a little bit through that? So obviously we talked about chronic primary pain. As I understand it, it means that if there's not a clear cause or clear etiology.
So that's the key distinction there is between chronic primary pain and chronic secondary pain. So secondary pain syndromes are things that have a clearly identifiable cause, and NICE has their own guidelines separate for that. But for chronic primary pain, it's where the pain has no clear cause or where the kind of distress or functional disability seems to be disproportionate to that observable injury or that condition.
I've got sort of figures in my head that about one in five people have chronic pain. Do we know the difference with what that breakup is? I'm assuming a substantial number have chronic primary pain.
These things very often overlap, and exact numbers are always difficult, but about 1-6% have some chronic primary pain syndrome.
Then thinking about initial patient coming into us in primary care, which might be in the current scenario, could be a telephone consultation, e-consultation, or may have a face-to-face appointment. What tips would you have around that assessment for a busy GP?
So, I mean, chronic pain that lasts more than 3 months. So you want to distinguish that, you know, this is something that has been persistent. And then a really important thing right at the beginning is thinking about your differentials. Primary pain is somewhat of a diagnosis of exclusion. So you want to make sure that you've ruled out secondary causes. So that's considering your rheumatological differentials, your musculoskeletal differentials, and depending on where that pain is, because you can have chronic primary headaches or chronic primary abdominal pain or fibromyalgia, may help guide you in choosing investigations to rule out those differentials where possible.
Obviously we do that holistic assessment in primary care, which I think is really important around understanding the pain and how that affects function and day-to-day activity. And obviously there's a lot of overlap, I think, from clinical experience of anxiety and depression in these patients sometimes.
Absolutely. Pain itself is profoundly debilitating, and that affects your function, affects what you can do physically, but obviously it's going to affect your psychological welfare. But then the side as well, for those who suffer with anxiety, depression, often that can manifest through pain. So, you know, they are closely linked. And I think that probably explains why the evidence seems to suggest that antidepressants are the only medication where the benefits seem to outweigh the risks in this group. You know, they really do show some benefit.
So then think about that, the patient, we've come in, we've done our initial assessment, we thought holistically about the psychosocial impacts on patient. And then, as you mentioned, we might want to do some blood tests. I think in my typical chronic pain patient, I might think about doing some FPC, CRP, I guess called ruling out any other causes of pain. Would that be your sort of approach as well?
Very much so. You want to make sure that you're not missing something, and this is truly kind of a primary pain rather than a secondary syndrome. So I think really appropriate to kind of do those blood tests and appropriate investigation, particularly with telephone consultations and that telephone first model we have at the moment, being cautious about having a low threshold to bring these people in and really examine them, set eyes on them, I think can be a really powerful approach.
I certainly think so. Obviously, we're still having a sort of hybrid model, but I think there's a lot to be gained from also examining patients and de-skilling in that area, and actually patients like it and clinicians like it. So I'm moving slightly towards more examinations as appropriate for patients. So we move to that stage, we do the blood test. The blood test seems to be either normal or not concerning, and then think about that chronic pyemy pain. And then what would you discuss with a patient sort of management plan? I mean, it might be on the first consult, it might be the second consult. And I think in primary care, we might have a picture over time, isn't it? Maybe a couple of consultations with a patient.
This is definitely, I think, with any chronic condition, things will happen longitudinally over time. And as GPs, we're well placed because we have that long-term relationship with patients and we can think about that holistically. So I think taking the holistic approach and working out, you know, what matters to them, what their aims are, and also thinking of, you know, setting expectations that it may be that we can't completely eradicate the pain, but if you can get to 50% improvement over a certain time period, or that we can allow them to do certain activities in life, I think that approach is quite helpful. But having a very honest and open discussion about the treatment options available. From my experience and from, I think, the literature, patients often will come with an expectation, perhaps, of painkilling medications because they're in pain. So it makes sense that they might want painkillers, you know, because that's what you do if you've got a simple head and acute pain. But I think what this guideline helps us do is have a really honest conversation with them. And so actually the evidence shows that for all analgesic medications, whether it's your simple ones, your paracetamols and your ibuprofens, or your more complex, you know, opiates, gabapentinoids and all those things, the evidence of benefit is significantly outweighed by the risks of long-term harm.
It's a real challenge.
Yeah, when you've got a patient in front of you who's saying, I'm in pain, give me something, you don't want to be seen as the gatekeeper that's just saying no. It's a challenging conversation. And again, with all these things, that it's tailoring the guideline to the individual, but offering them alternatives is the way to go. And so NICE recommends broadly three types of non-pharmacological options for it. So physical therapy and exercise programs have shown to have been benefit. Acupuncture, 5 hours of sessions, have both evidence for short-term benefit of up to 3 months. The long-term evidence is unclear, but it's definitely worth it to discuss with the patient. Psychological therapy is definitely, as we touched on earlier, because of that close overlap between pain and anxiety and depression, psychological therapies can help both underlying mental health problems that may be driving the pain, but also help you cope with it. So the two types of psychological therapies that it recommends is one is CBT, cognitive behavioral therapy, that is quite well recognized. The other one, which is kind of less well known, is ACT, acceptance and commitment therapy, which is an approach that tries to promote psychological flexibility to enable you to accept the pain. And so it may be that you don't ever get rid of the pain completely, but it gives you that psychological resilience so it doesn't dominate your life as much.
I think that's really good discussion and overview of that area. I mean, there is, I think, also a gap between the guideline and clinical practice. I don't have access in my area to acupuncture. I think probably a lot of people don't. I guess that's a sort of treatment and commissioning gap, which, you know, could drive a little bit of inequality because most people are going to have to pay for it. Yeah. And working in a deprived area, that means, you know, there's sort of that gap between guidance and actually what we can offer to our patients.
Well, it's the old inverse care law again, you know, and we know that chronic pain tends to be higher in areas associated with deprivation, and we tend to prescribe more of the painkillers in areas of deprivation. But as you said, often those resources are not available. And, you know, one of the critiques from clinicians of these NICE guidelines was very much that, you know, it's that there is the gap between what they say is the ideal and what's happening in reality. And I think particularly groups like the Faculty of Pain Medicine were very worried about that. Particularly the pain management programs and the commissioning of that was something that they were worried about. So that can present a real challenge when you're sitting with the patient.
And sitting with the patient, and yeah, absolutely. And long waits, we know, in many areas for physio or musculoskeletal therapies, and also chronic pain clinics can have long waits, which then it kind of puts in the situation about what can we offer a patient. Often patients have that expectation from us to prescribe. I know we don't have, we're electronic now, but this, rather than taking the prescription paper, they expect to get some pills from us. So that sort of challenging consultation around the chronic pain and what might be offered. I'm just thinking back to practice, I find with some chronic pain patients, that's once we've got to know them, they can have acute flare-ups. So sometimes I do have rescue packs of, for example, naproxen and a PPI, not for regular use, but for if they get acute flare-up of their chronic primary pain, sometimes that does work. I even had a patient, she got quite bad tummy abdominal pains, and I ended up prescribing her actually a non-steroidal diclofenac suppository, which she found very helpful for occasional use.
And I think you've identified there a really significant gap in the new guideline. The NICE guideline recommends that you recognise and acknowledge and reassess at the point of a flare, because obviously the risk is you assume it's a flare of chronic pain, you may miss a new presentation of a new diagnosis. What it doesn't do is really give us any prescribing guidance. So having said very firmly against prescribing painkillers for chronic primary pain, it leaves us in a bit of uncertainty what to do with these acute flares. And you could say that this leaves room for clinicians' discretion and whether you see this flare as an acute on chronic pain. So you're treating the acute pain. And again, it's about having that conversation with the patient about the duration of this acute course, acknowledging this is not something you want them to be on forever because of the side effects, but whatever the length of course that you agree on to deal with this acute flare.
And I guess trying to avoid opioids only as much as possible. I know there's kind of a big push to de-prescribe opioids and kind of reduce people started, because it can be quite easy for patients to have a tolerance. We all see that in primary care and challenging consultations with patients who come to iatrogenic harm from prescription medications.
Opioids were particularly picked up on by SINE, the Scottish Intercollegiate Guidelines Network, in their 2019 chronic pain guidelines. So that preceded the NICE ones. Their real focus was on restrictions for opioid prescriptions because of the significant harm they were seeing. And I guess that leads on to the next challenge with this NICE guideline is, you know, what do you do for those patients who are already on all these medications, whether it's the opioids or whether it's on gabapentinoids or whatever it is? How do you have that balance between reviewing their medication and deprescribing? Because if the pain medication is working for them, then you don't want to deprescribe it just on the basis of a guideline, you know, tailor it to the patient. But at the same time, if they're not getting much benefit from it, I think this guideline gives us a bit of space to open up that discussion and say, look, if it's not doing anything for you, we do know that they can cause you a lot of harm in the long run. So maybe doing a trial of withdrawal, you know, in a safe way, negotiated with the patient, maybe something to think about.
Now, I guess from the start point, maybe try and avoid long-term opioids in any of these patients.
Yeah, absolutely.
Potentially small doses for acute, but I don't try to avoid them as much as possible, having seen patients harm from it. Obviously, the caveat, opioids are good painkillers, and particularly for palliative care, fantastic drugs. So I'm not against necessarily prescribing them, but I think chronic primary pain generally don't have a role unless it's very much a short course for acute flare-ups.
I think that's right. As with all drugs, it's choosing the right agent at the right time. And what you don't want to do, as you've said, is burden these patients with significant side effects and addictions in the long term.
We've said the importance of non-pharmacological treatments, difficulties with that. So going a little bit more dive into the antidepressants. So could we reflect a bit about that and about which ones we might start or try?
The evidence review from NICE showed that use of antidepressants for chronic primary pain showed evidence of benefit for the pain itself, but also for quality of life, for sleep, and for psychological distress. And that included those with and without a diagnosis of depression. The use of antidepressants in those without a diagnosis of anxiety depression is an off-license use, but this guideline shows that it would work. One of the challenges of antidepressants, as with all medications, is that they come with their own side effect profile, and no drug is a silver bullet. And having an honest conversation with patients about the risks as well as the benefits. But in the case of antidepressants, the evidence seems to suggest that the benefits outweigh the risks for them. In terms of what antidepressants to use, I think the jury's out with that. There's insufficient proper head-to-head data on this, and further research is definitely needed to look at this. The greatest body of evidence is particularly for duloxetine, which has been used for a long time in fibromyalgia. And one systematic review showed that in order to get a 50% pain relief, the number needed to treat from duloxetine was 5.8, which is really remarkable in terms of number needed to treat. So that's potentially a starting point. But again, it's all about tailoring it to the patient.
I guess a difficult decision. Are you that one patient, or are you the five or six patients that doesn't get any benefit? As I say, it's that continuity of care is important, and having follow-up. If we are trying as antidepressant, GPs will be very experienced in this, having discussion about the pros and cons, the side effects, starting. I would say start low, go slow, a safety profile, and arrange a follow-up check-in with the patient, and utilising new technology like AccuRx, you can do text messaging as well for patients, and their sort of narrative about how they affect. And I think also having that discussion about if there's concomitant depression, or if sedation is required, if you're having difficulty in sleeping, thinking about maybe one of the low dose tricyclics potentially.
Absolutely. And I think coming back to what we talked about at the beginning, this is a chronic syndrome. And so setting those expectations from the beginning that these, as with antidepressants, as you do it for any condition, it's not going to change overnight. And it's about looking how it's going to change over the next few months, not days and weeks.
how we might approach depression as well. Because we'd be starting prescription, but we often say it doesn't start straight away. You're looking at initial prescription 4 to 6 weeks, then reassessing that it might take a few months. And once you're on treatment, you want to maybe want to be at 6 to 12 months at least, along with therapy, along with all the other non-pharmacological treatments that we discussed to see what works. Summarizing a bit, we've looked at the guidelines and you've written the paper. And then, Adam, just thinking about maybe the more challenging consultation. So rather than that first patient, but we touched briefly on it, following up these patients to seeing what works and what doesn't work. And that's like a big part of our work as GPs. Any sort of top tips on that?
I think the key with all these things is coming down to that relationship with the patient and being honest with them about what's going on. And pain does funny things to you. When you're in pain, you just want them to get rid of the pain. And so I think acknowledging that experience of the patient themselves and they just want something to help is really important. And so that frustration that they're experiencing, often you'll be experiencing as well. And so trying to keep that dialogue as open as much as possible and being open about what to expect, but also what the drawbacks of what the different approaches are would be what I'd recommend. And always keep an open mind to make sure that you're not missing that underlying pain condition. You're not missing a rheumatoid arthritis or endometriosis or something that's maybe presenting atypically.
Yeah, and absolutely. And if someone is representing with acute flare, you need to revisit the diagnosis. Is this the chronic pain syndrome or is there something else going on? Which is always very difficult. And that's the challenge of primary healthcare and clinical practice. It's like thinking about when things are worsening, when do you revisit diagnoses and do we then repeat blood tests, etc.
You know, there was an editorial, I think, last year, which talked about the overlap between chronic pain and distress and the risk that in using perhaps excessively anti-painkillers, you know, we've been medicalizing distress. And I think acknowledging that people often live challenging lives and that for them may manifest with pain, and just having an open discussion with them about that and listening to them clearly is often a good start, you know, could be therapeutic in itself.
And there is a big rise in antidepressant prescribing, and I think this guideline may push that for even further forward.
Well, yes.
And we seem to be challenged from the media saying we're overprescribing these medications. I think that's a really difficult balance, and we individualise that to the patient, see what their ideas, concerns and expectations are.
I think the prescribing rates of antidepressants are worrying, not necessarily to suggest that we're overprescribing, which we may be doing, but suggests that our general approach to mental health is struggling and just patching it over with medication. But I feel that's probably a whole nother nice guideline waiting to be written.
Yeah. Some top tips for me from looking at these guidelines is, I mean, obviously there's the signed guideline you mentioned. I think there's a really good booklet that Signe produced. It's a patient booklet, which actually goes through chronic pain and it talks about the different interventions in a patient-friendly way. I've sent that links to patients via text message so they can have a look and weigh up themselves, actually inform patients to make that informed choice about what intervention they might want to go for, different medication options. So I think that's quite a good tip. You know, often in these cases, I don't think you have to make a decision there and then. Often you can, in partnership with patients, say, what would they like? Would they like something prescribed, you know, sedating, non-sedating, what they'd like to do to try, along with these therapies that we talked about.
Absolutely. I know Signe have a good one. I think there's also living well with pain is something I've used before in the past that's quite helpful. I think in the consultation, there's so much going on. Giving patients something to take away afterwards to think about it is often something I find helpful. I think patients find helpful to help answer any questions that they have left.
And that's an online resource that patients can use.
Yeah.
You clearly identify there's lots of further research needed in this area. I know there are people researching further primary care based research in this area, including thinking about sort of developing toolkits and creating almost like an online virtual pain service for patients. So I think watch this space, because I think it's very challenging with waiting lists and lack of staff. And actually, could we use digital technology to help transform some of this area? And I mean, patients can access online CBT or other things, but obviously that is biased towards people who can read and write and use English well.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, always with caveats around this, but I think this definitely needs some further research and investment going forward.
And one thing that NICE touched on in their guideline was that the social prescribing was something that they didn't recommend at that time, not because of evidence it didn't work, but they just felt the evidence was probably not there yet. And specifically, we can pain management programs that the evidence is ongoing. So as you say, I think very much watch this space. And again, as we look with another latest reorganization, the ICSs, if you're hopeful and optimistic, may provide an opportunity for the community primary care and social care spaces to collaborate, and pain, it would feel, would be a great space for that to be treated there. So fingers crossed.
And I think another tip, we've got the British Journal of General Practice, it's our chronic pain papers just come out recently, 2022. We've got the link then to RCGP online learning. So we've got the EKU module. There's also a screencast and further content on the online learning environment for people if they're interested to get a bit more learning in this area. Thanks, Adam. And thanks, everyone, for listening. You are listening to the RCGP Essential Knowledge Updates podcast. Thank you.